So he's only gone and done it to me again, hasn't he? Everything was sorted. The podcast was in the can, just a few edits to do before work this morning. And then bam, on the news. And of course, I'm talking about the fat orange twit in the White House. This is icing on the cake stuff, surely. This has to be it, right? The leader of the free world has given super mega top secret intel to the Russians. Now, I probably need to stop saying the Russians. It's a bad habit, but you know, when I say the Russians, I'm talking about the oligarchy, Putin's crew. I'm not talking about the average Russian on the street. Anyway, so look, I'm pretty sure everyone knew something was up over the weekend because of Dum Dum's Twitter behavior. And it's not hard to recognize. It happens all the time now. Just before the next biggest fuck up, he goes on Twitter rampage. He must think it's some sort of diversionary tactic. Anyway, it turns out, as you probably know by now, he leaked some pretty critical information to his Russian visitors last week. You remember that, right? That was a visit where he excluded the American media from the room, but he let in the Russian media. Apparently, he didn't think they were going to take some photos because why would the media do that? Anyway, we'll get to the leak in a moment, but I do need to make a comment on it. I really don't think that he did this deliberately. Rather, I think he was trying to show off, you know, the sort of, yeah, I'm really important because I know stuff that our closest allies don't even know. And look, Dum Dum is so dumb that all it would have taken was for Sergey to challenge him on something and bam, the beans are spilled. And I think this is a bigger problem than the leaked intel, which of course is a big thing, but the fact that there is such an incapable, unintelligent fool with access to potentially deadly intelligence is just extraordinary. And you know what's going to happen, right? It's the dropping of the frog in the cold water and slowly turning up the heat analogy. Next week, if nothing's done about this, something else will have happened, something worse maybe, and we would have forgotten about this. Do you remember last year when he said he could walk down Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and get away with it? Seriously, how far do you think we are away from that? Think about all the bullshit he has done so far and got away with. And this has been the way it's been for him his entire life. This fucker gets to do whatever he wants, and because he's apparently rich, all the spineless fucks that surround him let him get away with it. You see, if you tell little Don Don no, you'll lose your meal ticket. Anyway, so what happened? Well, it's not all completely clear yet, and the media are probably being quite restrained, not letting too much information out because there's grave consequences to this. Anyway, the media are saying one thing and the Orange House is saying another. But who are you going to believe? H.R. McMaster said this morning, my time, that nothing was shared. No information was shared. He said he was there and that was that. And just now, before I started recording, I look at the news and he said the stuff that was shared was normal intel that you'd normally share with another government. Who do you believe? The office of the so-called person that insists beyond all photographic evidence that he had the largest inauguration crowd ever, period, or the legitimate media who so far have not been wrong? Anyway, the information that's pouring out of the leaks in the Orange House are telling us that the information was so highly classified that it hasn't been shared with all the United States intelligence agents or America's closest allies, but it's been shared with the Russians. Apparently, he shared details about an ISIS terror threat related to the use of laptop computers on aircraft. And the dumbass shared this with the Russian forest man. That's Sergey Lavrov and the Russian ambassador, Sergey Kislyak. Now, if that name rings a bell, it should do, because he was the person that's been accused by many sources of being Russia's best spy recruiter. Anyway, the information apparently had come from a third country, apparently a country in the Middle East, which is a bit of a problem, a Apparently, as there is speculation that the source country didn't want Russia or anybody else to know that it was working with America or had access to this information for reasons we probably will never know. But this has caused a massive shitstorm, so much so that an unnamed European country has said that it will no longer share any sensitive information with America. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a massive, massive problem. Anyway, it's all early news right now. The Orange House are denying it, but the leaky sieve that is the West Wing is proving to be a very reliable source. So much so that Dum Dum turned to Twitter today again to blame the guy that he sacked as director of the FBI last week for not finding the leaks in the intel community. And you know what? They can look there all they like because the leaks are coming from the West Wing, you dumb shit. The media are even telling you where the leaks are and you still don't believe them. But put that aside for a moment. Just because the president of the free world is a bumbling buffoon, that doesn't mean the rest of the world's leaders, friendly or otherwise, are. So how long do you think it will take ISIS to figure out how the intel got out, where the leak is? Remember, this is intel that was so sensitive that it wasn't meant to be shared with most of America's allies or American intel agencies. Apparently, this information is so specific that it will possibly expose sources inside ISIS. And you know what's going to happen to them, don't you? Look, I don't know what's going to happen. Is he going to do something even more buffoonified? Is a frog in the pot of water that's slowly getting heat turned up going to boil? Or is this it? Am I going to even get to the end of re-recording this episode and have to start again because he's jumped in Marine One a la Nixon and quit? Or be marched away in tiny little Barbie doll-sized handcuffs? Or perhaps he's taken Air Trump One for a one-way trip to Moscow. Here's a very possible thought. What happens if he actually does that and puts himself in exile? Maybe he'll seek asylum in Russia. Wouldn't that be a turn up for the works? I guess it's all that's left to say on that is just watch this space. All that aside, this weekend saw the passing of the baton, the change of power, if you will, of one of the planet's most influential political institutions. And of course, I'm talking about Eurovision. If you haven't seen this spectacular, you really, really should. I mean, the concept is no different to any other reality TV singing competition, even though Eurovision itself predates reality TV. It follows that standard concept. People get up on stage, sing a song, and then the public pays money to vote for who they want to win. And that person never actually wins. But Eurovision has a difference. The winner and losers of this singing or song competition is based on geopolitical situations. See, what happens is each country involved in the competition, and it's not just European countries, by the way. I'm sure if I spent a few minutes on the Google, I'll be able to tell you why, but let's face it, I really don't care. And it's not important to my story. Anyway, so each country of the countries involved form a committee. At the end of the competition, a representative from that country joins the commentators via some weird magic or fiber optic cable or something and announce who they have given their points to. They normally drag someone that was once musically famous to do this. For the UK this year, we dusted off Katrina from Katrina and the Waves. And here's the thing. It's pretty much never about the best song or performance. Not normally. And this has been one of the most criticized aspects of the contest, but it's a part of the contest. And of course, you must expect this to some degree. We see it in the Olympics where things are scored. But who would have guessed that you'd be able to tell the geopolitical landscape by a somewhat overly camp singing contest. But there was an actual change of power in Europe this week. Emmanuel Macron was inaugurated as the French president.
Bonjour, you cheese-eating surrender monkeys!
And not that you would have noticed due to the lack of media attention outside of France, though. And I only mention that because there was so much media attention for Emperor Dum-Dum, probably out of disbelief more than anything else, but this is... The French inauguration is an all-day public event. It's huge, with all the pomp and ceremony that you'd come to expect from the French. Maybe it's a crowd size thing, who knows. But what a lot of the media outlets did mention, the ones that did mention it, was how close the vote was between Marie Le Pen and Macron, and the reporting that Europe needs to think about the popularity of the far-right movement. Except for... there's a small problem. As they tend to like to do, the medias are talking shit because, as it tends to be everywhere right now, people are just not turning out to vote. And this is a worldwide problem. It's not a European problem or an English problem, American problem. It's a problem across the world. People are just not voting. This year in France was actually not so bad. There was about three quarters of the registered voters that had ballots that were counted. But consider this. Macron had just over 20 million votes. Le Pen had just over 10 million. But there were 12 million people that either didn't vote or deliberately spoiled their ballot. The last number I've seen on this was about 6 million voters cast a ballot that didn't count. So think about that for a moment. The media are telling us that the far right are a force to be reckoned with in Europe, yet more people didn't vote for the daughter of the Nazi or spoilt their vote than actually voted for Le Pen. But if that's not scary enough, consider this. And anyone not in Europe may not consider that this is an important political time in Europe right now. I get it, especially in America. You have big problems here. I get it. But given the Brexit decision and the threat of other countries thinking they might want to get out of the Union also, Europe really is a political powder keg, and Vlad the Putin seems to be the nut job with the flint right now. So obviously tensions are politically and economically tense. But just imagine what would have happened if Le Pen did win, or anyone else that was influenced by the Kremlin or was genuinely anti-European Union for that matter. The EU will have imploded. Most of Europe would have been in tatters, closely followed by NATO, which just happens to be Putin's endgame. But in the case of France, Macron was a viable progressive candidate, and we are luckier than most people can appreciate that France wasn't running the best of the worst candidates vis-a-vis America with Clinton and Dum-Dum. Or the general election in the once United Kingdom in 3 weeks' time. That brilliant and informative 10-part political documentary called South Park couldn't have gotten it more accurate when they pitted a giant douche and a turd sandwich as opposition candidates. And I'll talk more on this later, but it's exactly what we have for 3 weeks' time in the UK.
Hi, this is the voiceover robot. If you want to have each new podcast delivered as soon as it's released, go to skepticsmashtalk.com and subscribe.
So I guess by now everyone would have heard of the massive cyber attack that seems to have affected over 200,000 businesses and some private users all across the globe, including, and it seems to be the worst hit, ironically, was Russia. But for whatever reason, no one has really mentioned why this happened in the first place. Not really, anyway. We know that this was most likely as a result of stolen information from the NSA, and some people are suggesting that the virus itself was made by the NSA. I don't know how true that is. Of course, though, it's possible. But What is known is that Microsoft and everyone else for that matter knew that the vulnerability that this piece of malware exploited had been leaked. So Microsoft released a patch to close up the vulnerability. And from what I understand, they did this pretty quickly. But there's a little flaw in their thinking. They forgot that businesses, especially public bodies and services, don't like to invest in up-to-date systems. And look, there's brilliant reasons for that. You've got a proven system. Why risk anything else? But it seems one of the reasons that the NHS in the UK was hit so intensely was that they were, or still are, using Windows XP. Look, don't get me wrong. I think XP was the best operating system that Microsoft had or ever will produce. But they don't support it anymore. Why should they? It's 16 or 17 years old. So anyway, a support patch for Windows XP was not rolled out. But it's not just an XP problem. I know of at least one authority in the UK that was hit that was using Windows 7. And there was a patch for Windows 7. But again, due to the fear of some IT experts when it comes to patching systems before everybody else has tested the patches, some systems, as was the case with the authority on Windows 7, they just hadn't patched their system yet. They wait 8 to 12 weeks after a patch is produced before they roll it out. And really, that's the amazing part. Even kids know to keep their systems updated and keep antivirus software updated and back up and store vital information separately. It's the basics of living inside the tech revolution. But the tech experts think, nah, fuck it, I'll wait 12 weeks before we patch. Anyway, it seems as though the majority of the damage has been done, and all thanks to an anonymous 22-year-old developer that happened to be at home when he took a chance and thought about seeing if he could kill the program, which he did. And of course, that's brilliant, but for whatever reason, the media's told the world, including future cyber criminals, how he managed to kill it. So now they know what not to do next time. So thanks for that, I guess. But the reason I want to talk about this is not because I want to give lessons on cybersecurity, but I want to regale you with a slightly amusing story that started when I was about 10 years old. I think I was 10. I don't actually remember, but it was about then. Anyway, I was always curious when it comes to electronics and machinery, as you know, all 10-year-olds are. I would find bits and pieces of different things and pull them apart and put them back together again. And my male parent would even encourage me when he felt the need to parent. Anyway, somehow I had an old sewing machine, I think a turntable and some parts from a vacuum cleaner. I can't actually remember what I was trying to achieve, but I had all these parts and motors and pulleys and whatnot. Maybe it was some sort of Rube Goldberg machine. I remember I went through a phase of trying to find perfect mechanical advantage. I got obsessed with pull ratios and levers and pivots, all sorts. Anyway, like I said, I don't remember what I was building. It's 35 years ago. But the very moment I hit the power switch, the earth actually shook. I thought, fuck, I am a genius of the highest order. I've built a doomsday device and the world was going to tremble at my feet and pay me hundreds of dollars. That's a slight exaggeration. I really didn't have a concept of money back then. I think I would have settled for tens of dollars, but I really did think that I made the earth tremor. So I turned it off and then turned it back on again because I wanted to do it again, but nothing. So I thought I must need to reset it or something. You know, I remember spending the next few days trying to rebuild my sewing machine doomsday device, obviously to no avail. What had happened was just out of coincidence, I hit the button and there was an earth tremor. And I don't know how long after that I found out that I hadn't caused anything. I think it may have been days, it could have been years, I can't remember. But I never thought about it again until Friday. So I had the day off work and I thought I would have a go at making an internet. It can't be that hard, right? Tim Berners-Lee's done all the hard work. I just need to find some code that somebody else has already written. I just needed a bit of an operating system and a Raspberry Pi and put everything together, sort of copy and paste and copy and paste and rinse and repeat, so forth and so forth. And Because I'm much smarter than the giants whose shoulders I was standing on, I changed the code a little bit to speed things up and got rid of a heap of crap that whoever wrote the operating system thought was needed. You know, all the normal stuff that 45-year-old kids do when they think they're geniuses on the highest order. Anyway, I spent a good few hours writing the scripts and loading everything onto the Pi, and the last command I had to do was sudo reboot. And as I hit enter, that's when it happened. On the BBC News came the story that the Globe had been hit by a cyber attack, and I thought, fuck, I've done it again. Before we end today, I just wanted to do some very quick updates on the world of politics that's not about Donald Trump. But before I do that, I do want to address some feedback that I've had. And this isn't just one person. I'm not being defensive around. I'm not angry or pissed off. But I do get a lot of comments about the role of skepticism in politics. More recently, I had somebody get really pissy at me on the Twitter because I call myself a skeptic but tend to talk a lot about politics. I should be talking about science because that's what skepticism is all about, apparently. And I think I've talked about this in the past, but as far as I'm concerned, skepticism isn't just about science or ripping apart medical studies and pretending to understand p-values and flying spaghetti monsters. And if that's what people are interested in, that's fine. I love shows like The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe as much as the next person. Fuck, they've been doing what they do for 12 years. You want to talk about standing on the shoulders of giants. Skeptics with a K have been doing their thing for 7 or 8 years, and they're just as brilliant as what they do. But right now, in this moment in time, on this little fleck of rock, if there's one thing we really need to focus our skepticality on, is politics. Could you imagine a world where no one questioned Donald Trump or White House spies? Imagine a world where Dum Dum had the biggest inauguration crowd ever, period. Or where the only news that was to be trusted was Fox News because the fat orange emperor said so. And we never questioned our politicians. And right now, we are living in the once United Kingdom where the leaders of the main political parties who we need to vote on in 3 weeks' time refuse to debate each other. They refuse to talk to the people. We need to be skeptical about this. Because what happens if we don't? Well, imagine a world where half the population believed that not only did Brexit mean Brexit, whatever that means, but the NHS were getting 350 million extra pounds a week. And the once United Kingdom would get its sovereignty back. And that refugees were a threat to security, and that immigrant workers were Turk and all the Gerbs. And we can keep imagining that we would have access to the single market, but didn't have to obey the free movement of the factors of production, i.e. the workers and the capital, and that none of this would screw the economy to unrecoverable levels. But that did happen because of credulity, because people didn't ask questions. People believed these lying pricks for everything that they said. And that's why we need to be skeptical of politics. Anyway, that said, I've got just a couple of quick stories that I want to talk about. And the first one, sorry to have to do this, but again relates to Emperor Dum Dum. I think it sums up the entirety of his mentality. And look, I reckon we all know someone that has to be the best at everything or has to have the best things. If you just bought a new car, they will tell you how much better theirs is or what so much better deal they got, or you should go to the restaurant that they go to. You know what I mean? Everything is about them, always. They'll always get themselves in a conversation. And we see Dum Dum do this all the time. He's just a self-absorbed megalomaniac. I doubt anybody would actually argue with that, including his close friends. But if you turn your memory machines back, These were the same type of people that had to have something different to everyone else or more than everybody else when it comes to meal times, when they were kids. Like the kid that would only eat chicken nuggets, or the one that had to have tomato sauce on everything, or the kid that had to have that extra scoop of ice cream. And as it turns out, if you haven't already guessed, this is what Trump does. Look, we all have our little quirks. I have more than most people, but when I'm out eating with friends or other humans, we obey social conventions, but not dum-dum. It turns out that he eats differently to everybody else. He gets an extra boat of sauce for his meat. Rather than the vinaigrette that everybody else enjoys with their salad, he has Thousand Island dressing, whatever that is. As far as a tasty beverage is concerned, Dum Dum has Coke while the commoners get water. And you guessed it, when the ice cream is served, Big Boy Dum Dum gets two scoops while everybody else gets one. Because he's the big boy now. And that says it all. That's all you need to know about the 45th and last president of the United States of America. Whatever you have, he just has to have that little bit more. So if you've listened to me for the last year or so, you would have heard me bang on more than once about the war on drugs. If you haven't, let me give you the bullet points so far. A, it's failing. In fact, there's plenty of data that suggests that it's having a negative effect and has caused a criminal subculture that otherwise would never have existed if not for the so-called war on drugs. B, it tends to target minorities and the socially disadvantaged. And three, it was implemented by Richard Milhouse Nixon as a tool to silence African Americans and hippies. And with all that in mind, Foghorn Leghorn's residual twin brother Jeff Sessions last week has done what everyone expected him to do with regards to Barack Obama's stance on non-violent criminals. And he told his minions that they essentially have free rein to throw the book at anyone but anything. And yeah, it's that simple. And I know you're saying that if it's illegal, you shouldn't do it, blah, blah, blah. You're right. But the argument is whether or not the war on drugs is justified and or fair. And look, I'm not saying that all drugs should be decriminalized. There's some really nasty shit out there. But there is some nasty shit that's legal and much deadlier than things like pot. Alcohol is a very good example. Anyway, I've said all this before. And a few weeks back, I talked about the 13th Amendment to the Constitution and the legalized slavery in the American prison systems. Well, after Sessions' announcement, what do you think happened to the share price of the two largest private prison companies in America? Of course, you guessed it. The prices went up significantly. And share prices go up when there's confidence in the market and confidence in the product. And when a human being is the product or property that makes money for its owners, well, there's a problem. And the war on drugs is not just an American thing. It's infested the once free world. And why more states voted to legalize pot than voted for Hillary for president last year? In the UK, it's still illegal. In 2015, there were 87,247 new police cases opened in relation to pot. And it cost, in police hours alone, £31 million. That's about a million hours of police time that could be used to prevent actual crimes. That aside, what about the criminality that's linked to drug use? And I've covered this before, I know, but when you create a criminal subculture by prohibition, you create a much larger problem than the problem you think you're trying to solve. But again, I won't stop repeating this ever. This war on drugs and the criminality that it has created was implemented for one reason, and one reason only, to silence a part of society that had enough of being trotted on and treated less than everybody else rather than fellow humans. The war on drugs was implemented because a criminal president didn't want African Americans or hippies to have a voice or an opinion. So he sent them to war or he sent them to prison. So what about English politics? And that wasn't a Freudian slip. I said that because it seems that neither the unelected Prime Minister or any of her parliament of spineless minions care about the three other countries that make up the once United Kingdom. But as I alluded to earlier, it's not just the Conservatives. The fact of the matter is, we go to the polls in 3 weeks' time and none of the main parties have released their manifestos. So we, the people that are supposed to have a voice, supposed to have sovereignty, supposed to have an opinion, have nothing apart from sound bites, which was the one thing Theresa May said was not going to happen. In fact, have a listen to her say it wasn't going to happen. This is from the Andrew Marr show on the weekend.
Now I am joined live in the studio by the Prime Minister, Theresa May. Good morning, Prime Minister.
Morning, Andrew.
Can we agree to start with that the one thing that voters deserve in what you yourself have said is going to be a very, very, very important election is no sound bites?
Well, it is absolutely crucial because this is, I think, the most important election that this country has faced in my lifetime. That when people look at this election and when they hear what the politicians are saying, they think about the national interest. That should be what drives people when they go to vote.
Okay, that's pretty simple, pretty clear, right? But just a few seconds later, we get the sound bites. Just have another listen.
As we go through this election, every party will be talking about what they think is important. I'll be talking about
strong and stable leadership.
Well, I'll be talking, and there's a reason for talking about strong and stable leadership and having a strong and stable government. It's precisely because this is the most important election the country's faced in my lifetime.
So already we've got the strong and stable leadership. That's their punchline at the moment. And then for the second time, in less than a minute, it's the most important election the country's faced in her lifetime. There are sound bites. And look, credit where it's due. Her army of PR fools have come up with a good slogan, strong and stable, because she and they know that the main opposition party, the Labour Party, are in tatters. They're not strong and they're not stable and they have no leadership. So that's the drum she's going to bang. But we're not going to have sound bites. What we will have is the giant douche or a turd sandwich. But still, right now, as I'm recording this on Tuesday afternoon, what we don't have is a manifesto from any of the major parties. We have nothing we can hold in our hands and hold those bastards accountable to. And while we're on that subject, remember I talked a while ago about the UK parliamentary system where the party picks which candidates and where they'll run. And then rather than the candidate tell the local electorate what they stand for, they parrot their leader's agenda. And then when it comes to voting in the House, if the MP doesn't toe the party line, they get deselected, which essentially means they get fired. But not by the voters, but by the party dictators. Anyway, this isn't always the case. Sometimes the party leader will let MPs have a free vote. But normally, they do this when they really don't care what the result is, as is with the case with Mrs. Mabey's decision to allow her party a free vote on fox hunting. And by that, I mean she wants to introduce a bill to make fox hunting legal once again. I'll get to the details of that in a minute, but here's the kick in the nuts. She won't ever allow a free vote on something as monumentally important as Brexit or the Brexit negotiations. Her party in its entirety must do as the mum and aunt commands or they're out the door. How is this not a dictatorship? But I want to talk about fox hunting for a minute, especially for the non-British listeners. I want you to imagine this, and I'm sort of not sorry about the graphic details, but imagine you and a group of your mates from down the pub or your sports ball club or sewing circle or whatever, just imagine that every now and again, this clutch of working class companions and yourself meet in a park somewhere with your adorable four-legged friends. And at the blow of a whistle, you set your animals off to chase down and kill with their teeth a kitten or a bunny or some other cute animal that features in a Disney cartoon. How do you think that would go down? But if you're a part of the landed gentry and you have an army of hounds and a red coat with a frankly ridiculous-looking outfit and a bugle, you can gather for some pre-lunch fortified wine with a sideshow of animal-on-animal slaughter. But only after you let your hounds chase down their prey for as long as you feel necessary. That's what fox hunting is. It's not a cull. It's not to control populations. It's not to preserve livestock or chickens. It's drunk, overprivileged pricks on horses watching dogs slaughter an animal. And the unelected Prime Minister is actually going to introduce a bill for this to be once again legal. And once again, that brings us to the end of this week's show. Now, look, I'm sorry it's a little short, but most of what I recorded yesterday is now completely redundant. And just guess that's the world we're living in. Anyway, one more thing before I go. I do need to announce that there won't be a show next week. I won't bore you with the details, but I have some things that I need to get done that will take a lot of time and take over that schedule. So, and because of this thing that I need to do, I may need to completely change the release date for the podcast, probably to a Wednesday morning US time, depending on how the next sort of week or so goes. But have no fear, there's no abandonment. This thing will keep going. So all that said, thanks for joining me and thanks for listening. And don't forget, if you want to help the show, the best thing you can do is to subscribe on the iTunes and share the show with as many people as you can. So once again, thanks for listening, and until next time, I've been Jason Jones and this has been Skeptic Smash Talk.